I greet you in Jesus' name this morning. Yes, I have been riding on the edge of a cold the last 2.5 days, and it took a little bit of a turn for the worse overnight, and I did not ask Brother Jason if he was prepared, so we're just going to go with what we have here today. And I'm sorry, I only thought of it while he was praying. I should have added it with the announcements, and maybe you all, some of you that care, know about this already, that one of our faithful promoters and supporters at the upper building passed away about a week ago, Anna Mae Huff, Reverend Huff's wife. She was just there in December. We were there. So I'm assuming she was not ailing very long until she passed. I was, as I considered what to preach about today or what to think on, I thought it has been a while. I think of looking specifically, but it's been a little while since we actually just dug into a Bible story. And that's what we're going to do today, this morning. And I thought about having the children come up front, but I'm afraid it's going to get way too protracted, this story. So we're going to have a protracted Bible story. And then if we have time at the end, I have about 10 points, albeit they are brief, observations for us today. I didn't know what to what title to attach, and so a day or two ago, Madeline was telling me about, she's going over a math test and agonizing over the things she got wrong, a simple mistake. She's like, well, the next unit, we go into proportions, and I never had a proportion for a title, but I have a proportion for a title. What's the proper way to read that? Those of you who are not in sixth grade, that didn't have that unit yet. How do you read that? How do you read that title? "450 o'clock." Lincoln, did you not have it yet?
450 to 1.
All right, thank you. 450 to 1. And I only thought of it after I wrote it down that. The first Bible story that I think of when I think of that proportion is not the one we're going to look at. What's the first Bible story you might think of when you think of 450 to 1? Mount Carmel, right. Elijah and the prophets of Baal. It was 450 against 1. The Bible does not actually use this number even that we're looking at, but you will understand with time how we came up with this. So if you care to, you may turn to Judges, chapter 6. We're going to look at Gideon and the story around Gideon. And we're not going to, I might read a few verses here and there, but I'm just going to try and tell the story about three chapters worth of it. And look at this crude drawing. This is a map up here. If you're wondering what this is supposed to be, and I ought to just identify a few more things. That is, these little humps here are supposed to be mountains. Out here's the Mediterranean Sea to the west. Here's some mountains, and here's the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. That kidney-looking body of water is the Dead Sea with the Jordan River coming down through it. And we will... Am I coming through okay? Okay, I guess our technicians are working it over. I don't really like to wear this thing, but I thought for anybody that's listening in, if I'm running away from the microphone all the time, it will get irritating. So verse 1 here, chapter 6, tells us that the children of Israel had once again, many times, it seems like many times we read this, that they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And that's exactly what we have here in verse 1 of chapter 6. And the Lord made something happen. He allowed something to happen, and that is the Midianites came in and they took over. And it says here it was for 7 years. And if we were to read some of these verses, they did. They took over everything they could get their hands on. Verse 4 says they took everything they needed. And it says they brought in cattle and people, and it says innumerable. Now, we know that is true, but it's not true in the fact that God can number anything. If he numbers the hairs of our head, they could number these. But the idea is, verse 5, is that it was just a multitude, it says, without number. It's just a huge crowd. It was a group, and we're going to get to that number here in a little bit, or approximately, how many it was. And God reminded them here also in these first few verses that they were where they were because it was a result. The conditions that they were living in were a result of them not obeying him. And so all Israel was suffering. Not all Israel was doing what wickedly, but all Israel was suffering at the hands of Midian. Verse 11 is where the story begins that we so often think of, and that is the angel of the Lord came and sat underneath the oak tree right nearby where Gideon was working. And it says he was threshing wheat behind the wine press. And I'm assuming that was to stay hidden from other people's eyes. And I don't know. I Googled what a wine press in Bible times was, and they show it in a pit. But I don't believe, I personally don't believe that. I'm assuming, for sake of the story, that this was a structure that was above the ground. And Gideon was finding his place behind it, somewhere to try and obscure his presence so that they could at least get a little bit of food for their family or for their cattle. Remember, the Midianites were taking over and just scarfing up everything they could. I think I should have wrote what verse it was, but it says they were spoiled the increase. Right there is verse 4. They encamped against them and destroyed the increase of the earth. Till I come, I'm supposed to be writing on the map. Till I come unto Gaza. This is Gaza, down here in the bottom corner. Now, let me just get some more notes up here. Gaza's down here on the shore of the Mediterranean, and over here, somewhere down this area, is the people of Amalek, and they're in the story. And then up here, like all along this area, is where the Philistines area was, up along like the southern coast there of the Mediterranean. And Gaza was one of their cities. But they had moved on up. And the reason I have this dot up here, we'll look at later. But they inhabited this area. This was the area of Israel here in the mountains and even up in here along the Sea of Galilee. And on this side of the river as well, the different tribes were scattered around. But Amalek was down here. And the Philistines were up here. And they had, I didn't write it all down. But at one point in the story, Amalek became part of this whole Philistine endeavor. They had moved up into here along the coast. And there's no mountains along here for a reason. Because if you look on a topographical map, there isn't mountains here along the coast of the Mediterranean. But here it's full of mountains. And then here is the Valley of Jezreel. And that is where this story takes place. And I want to note at this point that I believe that we are beyond blessed to live in America and have the freedom and the peace that we have today. We haven't a clue, and I don't think, probably safe to say, none of us, even the oldest here, don't have a clue what it's like to live in oppression. We've just been too blessed for too long. Now, that is not the case everywhere around the world, and we know that. But for generations now, we have no real idea what this type of life would have been like. Gideon trying to sustain the life of his family, which there were many of them. At some point, there became many. His family and his cattle, by doing things in secret, just so they could survive. They were in survival mode here. We have no idea. I mean, we have ideas, but we don't know how it actually goes because we haven't lived it. So Gideon was doing his best with the prolonged situation that they were in. And on top of it, I think if I were Gideon, I would be thinking about this, that I'm in this situation and it's not anything to do with anything that I did wrong. I'm suffering as a result of other people that have done wrong and have not been honoring God. In fact, he was a righteous man living among disobedient people. So verse 12 there in chapter 6, the angel tells Gideon that the Lord is with you, the mighty man of valor, or something like that. And Gideon questions that in verse 13.
And he says, well, how is this possible? If the Lord is with us, why then is this evil? Why then has all this befallen? He harks back to the story of the Lord delivering the Israelites out of Egypt. And if God is with us, why is this happening? Verse 14, he's given the commandment by the angel, and that is, well, it says, the Lord looked on him and says, go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of Midian. Have not I sent thee? He told him to go, save Israel, to which he is very uncertain how that could be possible. He says, my family is the poor family of Manasseh, and I think that likely he felt deliverance was humanly impossible, and it was. Humanly, it was impossible to be delivered from the Midianites. It was not going to happen. It says they came in. Another spot says they came in like grasshoppers. This was a huge multitude. So he asked for a sign in verse 17. He asked for a sign from this heavenly being. And he went and prepared meat and bread and broth, and he brought it back. And the heavenly being said, lay the meat and the bread here on the rock and pour the broth out. And then he took his staff and touched the rock, and it was consumed by fire. The meat and the bread was consumed by fire. And this was a sign. Gideon asked for a sign, and this is a sign he got. He got a sign. So that's sign number one, and he's going to get three more signs yet from the Lord before this is all over. It says he built an altar on the Lord that same night, and he tore down the altar of Baal and cut the groves down and built an altar unto the Lord in that place as well. And early the next morning, the men of the city discovered that this grove had been cut down and the altar of Baal was torn down, and they went looking until they found who had done this. Who had done this deed? And they went to his dad, whose name was Joash, and said, bring this man out, because he needs to die for what he did. He tore down our place of worship for Baal. They wanted to kill Gideon. And this is people that are part of a group of people that cried out. Back in verse 6, it says, Israel was greatly impoverished because of Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. And I just had trouble as I was, it was a piece of the story I hadn't thought of before. So here they're critical and very upset at getting toward this altar down to worship who? What was Baal doing for them? We know he's doing absolutely nothing. But they cried out to God just not long ago, just shortly before this. They've been crying out to God. I don't think they obviously were not thinking. But Joash convinced the men to let Baal defend himself. This is such a big deal. Let Baal defend himself. Everything will be okay. Well, they moved away from that. Seems like they were pacified by that. And at that point, I don't know where they were, where the armies were before, but at that point, they moved into this valley of Jezreel, and that's this area in here. And just to try and get a little bit of a mental image, I think most of us have been over to Big Valley. Some of you live in Big Valley. So it's about approximately the same length as Big Valley, about 20 couple miles, is what this valley of Jezreel was going down to the Jordan River, not the whole way out to the coast, but just if you look on a topographical map, it's kind of a big U-shaped area. However, according to my map program, Big Valley, at one of its widest spots, is only about 3 miles, and this would be more like 10 miles. So just picture Big Valley, the length of Big Valley. If you ever see it from the air, I've seen it from the air a few times. It's one long valley, but do that three times wider. And now I don't know when I'm going to tell you how many people it was. I better do that now. According to later on in the book, in Judges, it tells us there was about 135,000 people. And that's an important number to remember. So just picture an area like Big Valley, three times wider. 135,000 people wouldn't fill it up. However, when you think of all the cattle and the people that were involved, it would take an awful lot. This has been going on for 7 years. It would take an awful lot to sustain these people. And if you look on a current map of that area today, it's all farmland. Most all of that is farmland. And so I'm assuming that's what it was back in that time. Because here's mountainous. This was a fertile area. So what better place to take a huge crowd of people and cattle but to some of the choice farmland of the very people that you're trying to, that you're besieging and taking over and just giving them a rough time. So at this point, it says that these armies moved into, and I didn't write the verses down, but it says they moved into this valley of Jezreel. And that's what that little dot is. That's the little town or city of Jezreel, but that whole valley is right there. It says, the Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon, and he blew the trumpet. And I suppose from what happened next, that trumpet blowing was to summon people, was to get people to come to him. And he sent out messengers throughout a lot. Okay, so the people over here didn't hear Gideon blow his trumpet. But Gideon's right here in this area, and he blew his trumpet. And then they sent messengers out to Ephraim, Manasseh, and other areas to bring in help, because he was given the commandment by the Lord to go and smite these people and take care of the Midianites. Well, Gideon had that direction. He gave direction to the messengers. I have it over here, verse 35. There it is. He sent messengers throughout all Manasseh and to Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali and told them to come up to meet him. He sent them out. And now at this point, verse 36, he says, if thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said, he's now asking for another sign. He said, I'm going to put out the fleece. And he wants a wet fleece and dry earth. And lo and behold, the next morning, a wet fleece and dry earth. Well, Gideon, you got the sign you're looking for. But no, he turns it around. He did get the sign he's looking for. But just to be sure, we know the story. He asked for a dry fleece and wet earth the next night. And sure enough, there was a dry fleece and wet earth. The dew was on all the ground. And so he was given energy by this. And so chapter 7, the battle cry had gone out, and the warriors of Israel had gathered themselves to the well of Herod. And I should at least point that out. We're going to see in a little bit that the Midianites in the story were encamped on the hillside over here, right off the coast of the Sea of Galilee on the north side of the Valley of Jezreel. And this well of Herod is down here, somewhere in this area. So they're across the valley is the well of Herod, where they gathered the people together. And I'm sure they were within view, within sight. I'm sure they could see 135,000 people, because that's a lot of people, plus all these animals. And very likely they could see the Israelites as well. He gathered by the well of Herod, and God tells Gideon that the Israelite army is too big, because he had promised to smite the Philistines. Why do I write Philistines here in my notes? It's the Midianites. He promised to smite the Midianites as one man. So there is 450-1. Each one of these dots represents 300 people in order for us to get our proportion. This is the Midianite host right here. That's 135,000 people. Take this times 300, there's 450 dots up here. And here is all the Israelite army that had gathered in. And if we look from who all got sent home later on, we're going to talk about that. There's 32,000 people. So right here, this is representative of 32,000 to 135,000. There is 4-1. 4 Midianites, 4.23 Midianites to 1 Israelite. And God says that's too many. Now, it doesn't take a very old person to look at that and say, well, that is, this far outnumbers this amount. There's just, that's never going to work. It cannot work. Well, but God said 32,000 is too many. Get rid of that. Anyone's just scared, go home. So 22,000 went home, and we're left with 10,000. Do you understand why Gideon is asking for another sign here in a little bit? No, I don't even think he asked for it. God offered it. But what would you be doing? I wanted to say this, and this is what I always try and do with stories. Let's enter into it. Try and enter into it as I was reading this story several times this week, just trying to enter into it. When I allow myself to get immersed in it, I just get fearful. This isn't, we know the end of the story, so it's all going to work out. This is not going to work out. There's only 10,000, 13-1. The odds are not even possible. Humanly speaking, there's no way God had told him back in those 32,000, he said, listen, if you go up against them and win, you're going to brag. You're going to brag about what you did. Now let's send some people home. You're going to say it was because we could do it. We were stronger than them. Four to one, we can do that. So he sent them, if you're scared, go home. So from natural view, there was 22,000 smart men, because I'd have been fearful. I'd have been shaken about this. Sent them home. And so now the odds were definitely stacked against them. 10,000, but God said 10,000 is still too many. Let's go and take the men down to the water for a drink. And I have no idea, but that's what God wanted. 300 men that would try and lap water like a dog. A year or two ago, when April's dog was still at our house, we tried to take a slow-mo of a dog lapping water. I don't know if you ever did that. Slow-motion picture. And probably some of you already know this, but we had to use the video to figure it out. This is not part of the message. But the dog's tongue actually inverts and curls back and pulls the water up into its mouth. It doesn't pull it up in the front. It curls down around and scoops it up in. Now, unless these were some 300 special human beings, they didn't curl their tongue down around and pull water up into their mouth. They were lifting it up with their hands, it says, cupping it in their hands, and lapping it up like a dog. While the others went down, what would make the most sense, down their knees and stooped over. And you know, I would just plunge my face right in that well of Herod, I guess is where they were. I don't know if that's where they were or not, but there was water right there to get their drink. But God said, Gideon, we're going to separate these men based on how they drink, how they get their drink. And so now there's 300 left, which got us to down to our proportion. And now, remember, each dot equals 300 men. And so there we are at a truly, humanly, completely impossible scenario. 300 men against 135,000. It will not work. Again, that's the human perspective. So let's think about this. What would be a real life ratio? Okay, so we see the dots, but I had to think about trying to use proportions that we can maybe connect with. That'd be like a regular, let's be like Pastor Jason as a 6-foot man compared to a stink bug, roughly. When you take his height, about an 1/8 inch. Now, I don't know what he weighs, but weight ratio would be a very large mouse or a small rat. Now, how fearful would that little creature be underneath a normal American man's foot? Okay, you get the picture. It is humanly impossible. I think you get the point. But this is exactly what God wanted. He wanted this humanly impossible scenario so that he could shine, so the kingdom could shine the greatest. So God now offers Gideon another confirmation. And so he sneaked to the edge of the camp, and he began to eavesdrop on this interesting conversation. And we know the story where one man says, well, you know, last night I had a dream. And the dream was that this barley loaf rolled into the camp and struck a tent, and it fell down. Well, it says it toppled. It toppled the tent. It flipped it over. That is in chapter 7, verses 9 to 14. And just for us, again, I'm making some assumptions, but it'd be the equivalent of a hamburger roll, a Kaiser roll, knocking over a 2-man tent. Again, that's not even possible. But God sent Gideon down to hear that conversation, and it flipped it. And if you use ratios for that, it's about 9,000 to 1. Now, all of a sudden, the testimony that Gideon is getting is that the God of Israel is like a 9,000 to 1. Maybe he didn't think of it that way, but that's what the odds were. And I know it's not right to use the word odds when we're referring to God, but Gideon and his servant got up. They got the boost they needed, and they went back to the camp and divided into 3 groups of 100. And Gideon gave the instruction. He says, carry the pitcher and the lamp in your left hand and carry the trumpet in your right hand. And The Bible tells us, I don't have the verse written, but it says it was at the beginning of the second watch. Now, unfortunately, I allowed Google to help me with this rather than pulling out my Bible dictionary. But it says the night was divided up into 3 4-hour watches. And the first watch was around dark, which they figure was around 6, 7 o'clock. And the second watch was probably beginning at 10 p.m. And so I just had to think, take all modern conveniences away. If you've been sitting in darkness for 2, 2.5 hours, what is most likely to be happening? You're in the early stages of sleeping, which is likely when we're in our, usually our deepest sleep is right soon after you fell asleep. So within the first hour of these people sleeping is when the stage, when God is saying, I just think it's just very interesting how God can work in his 9,001 or whatever that is. Perhaps they had the moon. I'm not sure how they could see to walk, but they surrounded this encampment. And remember, this is just across the valley. At this point, people are going home. They're going back to their tents, whatever was home. And they went from this, well, they were over in this area somewhere, and they surrounded the army and the cattle on this hillside. Split up, and they surrounded this group. And Gideon said, I'm going to give you the cue when I blow the trumpet. And so he just blew on that trumpet, and it was heard, and everyone else did the same thing. Broke those pitchers, probably made a racket. I don't know if it was that great of a racket or not. But when 300 men are blowing on that trumpet, surrounding them, and yelling, can you imagine what you would have done if you had been comfortably in your bed in a deep sleep? It's no wonder there was confusion in the camp, and every man pulled his sword on the other. And I don't know how laid back camels and cattle are, but I assume that when you get 1,000-plus-pound camel creating a ruckus, because of the ruckus, there's probably a bunch of trampling that went on, and slaughter was probably happening that way. The entire camp came unglued, thrashing about in the tents to get out in this darkness. They didn't just switch on the headlamp. No, there was no fire. They probably didn't even have a fire burning outside. It was likely not wintertime. And only to get out of their tent and see this ring of fire surrounding their encampment and the trumpets being blown. I'm sure it was a fearful experience for these many knights. They had no clue what was coming at them. And this is where we often end the story. This is where we say, now we go to the 10 points. We have a little bit more. Then we're going to go on. I believe people all around heard the commotion because it says that they came from here and there. It doesn't say in those words, but they came to help chase after the Midianites that were still alive. And the Midianites, the reason I flipped this over, this board back, because they're in this area, and they begin to run, and they begin to go towards the Jordan River. And somehow, I guess they're on foot, but somehow Gideon gets a message to men over here and says, cut them off or protect. Watch the Jordan River. They're going to get that direction. And some of them got there, and the Bible tells us that some of them got on over into the wilderness of Arabia, got chased over, but many of them, probably the vast majority of them, were killed in somewhere in that 15-mile run. Chapter 8, verse 13, I don't know what to make of it, but it's the Bible, and so I believe it would be true. It says, Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle before the sun was up. Let's say the sun rose at 6 o'clock, and we probably started this around 10. So he and his men, according to the in-between verses, would have ran for 15 miles, and they were heading back before the sun was up. Now, that is supernatural. That is not normal men. Now, we know there's some other conditions in the story. They were asked for help, and sustenance did not get, and those men were judged later. And Gideon settled those scores with men that were not willing to help God's people. So it's only natural that we get to verse 22 of chapter 8. The men of Israel said unto Gideon, rule thou over us, both thou and thy sons' sons also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. What could be better for the people of Israel than to have this man and his family to rule over them, because they had delivered them from Midian that had been oppressing them for 7 whole years. Gideon said, no way. They're not going to do that. But he did ask them to give up the gold that they had plundered, and he made an ephod. I don't know what an ephod is for sure, but it's a thing that the priests would wear, a piece that came over. They wear them during special times of worship. The priests would wear this, and he made this out of this gold. Verse 26, it says, the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels, besides the ornaments and collars and purple raiment that was on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were about their camels' necks. So I'm sure these priests, we didn't read them, not priests, the princes that were on camels earlier in this chapter, I have no idea how big this ephod was, but the earrings themselves had to be somewhere between 40 and 65 pounds, according to what I could research, as far as the weight of a shekel. It says there was even more to go with it. So that he made this ephod, and I think it was probably so they could remember what happened. But the unfortunate thing is that Israel began to exalt the large ornament rather than God. It says, and Israel went a-whoring after it. They had not gotten rid of the idol worship that was in their hearts. However, because of Gideon's faithfulness, the land had quietness, the Bible says, for 40 years in verse 28 of chapter 8. They lived in quietness. The story doesn't end there, but we're going to stop the story there and go into observations for today. So real quickly, I'm just going to read down over them. And this is observations. Back in chapter 6, they were where they were because of sin. And our distance from God directly affects our vulnerability to the enemy. They would not have been vulnerable to Midian had they not been distant from God. Number two, we quickly get interested in God when everything is crumbling around us. And I think that's a universal thing. Even wicked people today all of a sudden get interested in God when things are crumbling around them. Number three, verse 11, God's mercy reaches the needy that seek him. Verse 11 tells us that God stepped in. He heard their cry, and then he did step in. He sent that man to meet with Gideon. He stepped in to help Israel. And also in verse 11, number 4, God notices when we're doing our best with the conditions that we're in. Gideon was threshing wheat behind the winepress. He was doing the best he could with the conditions that he had. And God recognized it, and he called him a mighty man of valor, a courageous man, because of what he was doing. Number 5, verses 25 to 32 here in chapter 6, where Gideon went and ripped down the altar of Baal and cut down the grove. The observation for us is God empowers us when we allow his mercy to change our hearts. Gideon could not have done that and gotten away unscathed except that God's mercy was on him and gave him the power to do it. Number 6, that's the end of chapter 6, where he asked for a sign. God is fine with us asking for confirmation. I take from this story, as long as I'm trusting in God's hand. Gideon did not question God. He just asked for a confirmation. Maybe he questioned him, but not in the way. He did not get arrogant or bullheaded as Moses did when he said, God, I can't do this. We aren't going to be able to do this. Sometimes we ask for confirmation because we're doubting. Moses made God angry because he said, I can't do it. But I don't see anywhere here that God got annoyed by Gideon asking for confirmation. Was it perhaps there was a difference because God asked him to defeat an enemy, an army that was an enemy of God, and the other was God was asking to lead? And we could go on with that thought. Do we doubt and ask for confirmation? Are we more prone to doubt when God's asking us to do something in his army rather than living uprightly? I don't know. Number 7, God wants to work for his people. That's what I take from this story. He wanted to deliver them, but he needs trust and obedience. And we have story after story in the Bible here of God's people in an overwhelming odds situation many times. And I don't know that there's a story where trust and obedience to God meant defeat for the people. I don't know if there is one, tell me about it. But every time the people reached out in obedience and trust to God in the Bible here, they had deliverance from whatever was, from whatever oppression they were in. I know that we're studying Sunday school right now at a time when it appeared and felt like many were being defeated because they were following God. But it was working to expand God's kingdom. That was a time it was working to expand God's kingdom in probably a way unlike than it would have any way otherwise. And trust and obedience in the end will always bring the right result, the right end result. It may not feel good in time, but in eternity it will not just feel good, it will be overwhelmingly good, the reward of living in trust and obedience. And number 9, final point, God is far above what we ask or think. Ephesians tells us that. Far above what we ask or think. And it also says it's according to the power that worketh in us. We have that power that works in us, which helps it and makes it to be above what we ask or think. The odds aren't even a part of God's thoughts. He doesn't think in terms of what are the odds of this situation, because that's not, God cannot even think along those lines. And I don't know what your thoughts or life is like, but I do know that if you're on God's side, there's nothing like the odds being stacked against you, because God is here to deliver us. Success and victory must be taken in stride and not exalted. Oh, that was number 10. I didn't write that. That's what happened with that ephod. Success and victory were not taken in stride. They were exalted rather than keep turning back to God. And that was where the story fell apart. After those 40 years of Gideon judging Israel, things fell apart. So my final question, are you allowing the God that is greater than all odds to motivate you and to make you shine, to radiate his kingdom to those around you? Let's kneel for prayer.